This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. What do you suppose this economy is going to look like when this pandemic is over? Because it will eventually be, you know. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Tuesday, today, the 15th day of February. Good as always to have you along, everybody. This post-pandemic economy in just a bit, but there is, it seems, a glimmer of diplomatic hope today about Ukraine. Some movement of Russian troops away from, not toward, the Ukrainian border. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz was in Moscow today and said some moderately promising things. President Biden offered remarks this afternoon that while serious, we're not all doom and gloom. And with diplomatic hope often comes economic relief. And there was some of that today, too. Stocks were already up on the day. They stayed there. Bond yields, often a gauge of geopolitical agita, stabilized. And oil backed down off the 7-year highs. It has been bouncing around of late. But both crude benchmarks, that would be West Texas Intermediate, of course, and Brent crude, still closed above $91 a barrel. And we told you yesterday about how supply could be affected by whatever happens in Ukraine, which has analysts, it should be said, talking about $100 a barrel oil for the first time in years. Thing is, that equation, the price equation, is supply and demand. So, Marketplace's Andy Euler gets us going.
Allow me to nerd out on an economic term real quick. Elasticity of demand. Now, historically, the amount of gas Americans buy has been pretty inelastic, meaning it doesn't change that much when prices go up. Troy Vincent works at the data and analytics company DTN. He says gasoline's historic inelasticity relied on a couple of things Americans have always done: drive to the store to get groceries and drive to work.
In the coming months, we might see that higher price for gasoline, that people respond to that by doing, you know, more of what they did during COVID, which was get things delivered to home and also commute less to work if they have that flexibility.
That's here in the U.S., but oil is a giant global commodity. Greg Priddy, an independent energy consultant, says worldwide population growth and developing countries buying more cars will lead to more overall demand for oil and its refined products. In fact, he thinks we'll get back to pre-pandemic levels pretty soon.
Demand was rising each year before that. So we're kind of back on that growth track.
On the consumer vehicle side, though, higher fuel costs might have prompted some people to change their behavior, says Kelly Sanders at the University of Southern California.
Some of it's probably price provoked, but I think there's also a lot of, you know, there's a transition happening and people are starting to get on the bandwagon.
Electric vehicles are still a small part of the market. 10% of the new cars sold worldwide last year were electric, says the International Energy Agency. That is up from 2.5% in 2019. Now, if that trend were to continue, the elasticity of demand for gas might start to change. In Austin, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
If you're keeping track, we've made it about 4.5 minutes into the program today without talking about inflation. So maybe that's long enough. Huh? Because we got the latest reading on wholesale inflation this morning. The Producer Price Index, it's called PPI in the vernacular, up a full percent January from December, up nearly 10% from a year ago. One key component of that whole thing, lumber. And if you think for a second about what lumber is used for, it'll make sense. Marketplace's Justin Ho has that one.
First, there is a whole lot of demand for lumber, thanks to the booming housing market and new construction. Mark Vittner is senior economist at Wells Fargo.
The number of apartments that are under construction today is the highest it's been since 1974.
And Vittner says the bulk of single-family home construction is happening in the South. As a result,
that allows for more construction to take place during the winter months. And I think that's putting a little bit more seasonal pressure on lumber prices.
But lumber supply has been dealing with plenty of issues, too. For one, there's a shortage of workers available to move lumber.
The whole transportation sector between rail and trucking has slowed down.
That's Brian Leonard, a lumber analyst with RCM Alternatives. The spike in lumber prices in January doesn't reflect any disruptions from the trucker protest at the Canadian border. But Canada is a major supplier of lumber to the U.S., and British Columbia was hit with torrential rains late last year, which washed out lumber transportation routes.
It just devastated some rail lines and some highways, so it's just been a logistics nightmare times two.
And then there's Omicron. Greg Kuta is CEO of Westline Capital Strategies. He says lumber mills in Canada and the U.S. have had a lot of employees calling out sick lately.
Instead of having call-offs of 15%, you have call-offs of 25, 30%. So instead of running two shifts, you're running a shift and a half to one shift.
Kuta says all that lumber will eventually move through the supply chain bottlenecks, especially since producers have an incentive to sell as much as they can.
Whether it's Canadian, U.S., European, you're going to bring supply from all over to take advantage of these returns.
And as that happens, he says lumber prices could come down. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Wall Street Today, we already touched on invasion and inflation don't seem to be bothering traders. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Well, we made it 4 minutes without talking about inflation. We are not going to make it another four, though. Andy Euler did oil. Justin did lumber. Lots going on. Pandemic stuff, supply chain stuff, which is also pandemic stuff, of course. Government spending stuff. And now a new paper from the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago teases out the inflationary effect of labor market stuff. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that story.
Bryce Duby is the rare guy moving out of Austin and back to a coastal city this week. Kind of novel. What's not so novel is why. He quit his job for a better paying one in Washington, D.C.
That sort of COVID burnt out really made me sort of rethink a lot of things as far as where I was in my life, what I was doing.
The number of Americans quitting their jobs has hit new highs over the last year, and that plays a significant role in rising wages, says Leonardo Melosi, a co-author of the Chicago Fed paper.
By eliciting external offer, workers can put the current employer and external employers in competition.
More competition for workers equals higher wages, which often equals higher prices. That's contributed to about 1% of the inflation we've seen over the last year, says Melosi. And it's happening against a backdrop of a growing economy and low unemployment. Typically, this rate of job searching by already employed people only happens during recessions.
Because people, they are afraid to lose their job.
Then, when the economy recovers, they tend to lose interest in job searching. That's partially why wages didn't go up so much after the Great Recession, even though unemployment dropped to historic lows. But right now, workers aren't just responding to the typical business cycle, says organizational psychologist Anthony Klotz at Texas A&M.
Individuals decided to make life pivots during the pandemic for any number of reasons. These pandemic epiphanies.
He expects resignations will slow down a bit in the coming year, but probably stay somewhat elevated for a couple more years, which means wages could continue to rise. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
As we move into the third year of this pandemic and hopefully out of another surge, it's pretty clear that COVID is something we're going to have to live with forever. That's not to say we are going to be living in a pandemic forever, but who does get to say when the pandemic is over and what might that world look like? Marketplace's Kristen Schwab paints us a picture.
Do you ever find yourself dreaming about the end?
Actually, there's one time where I dreamed about going to the beach, that COVID was over, and trying coconut juice.
That's 9-year-old Olivia Jean-Baptiste in Chicago. She says she'll know COVID is over when she can do regular kid things again.
There was one day that one of the students in my class for dance got tested positive, and that ruined my weekend. My friends can't come over.
Everyone has their own version of what the end looks like. Sava Farah, a restaurateur in Ann Arbor, Michigan, says it's when she feels like her business is stable again.
We just need security in the fact that, like, we don't think we're going to close again.
For Priya Sampathkumar, an epidemiologist at the Mayo Clinic, it's over when she stops seeing so many deaths.
Dealing with that is hard. Every patient you lose takes a little bit of you.
Death rate, infection rate, and time between new outbreaks is what public health experts will use to decide when the pandemic is officially over. But Sampathkumar says it's likely that COVID will stay with us as a seasonal virus that peaks each winter.
We will see flares in different parts of the world, but it'll all become much more manageable, and we'll be able to handle it kind of like we do the flu.
When this will happen is harder to predict. Sampathkumar is hesitant to say we're nearing the end because that's what many people thought before Omicron. The World Health Organization has yet to set metrics for when what it calls a public health emergency of international concern will end. But J. Alexander Navarro, a medical historian at the University of Michigan, expects local governments to signal their version of the end earlier by relaxing public health rules. That's what happened during the Spanish flu. Most of the U.S. decided it was over in 1919, but half the country continued to see outbreaks.
It was way too premature to declare that pandemic over. But there was a lot of social pressure to do so. People wanted to get back to life as normal.
Sound familiar?
So there's an inevitable politics to declaring a pandemic over.
Keith Whalew is a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton. He says it's pretty easy to mark the beginning of a public health crisis. It's harder to define its ending. And that's because if a virus isn't eradicated, the threat of it never fully goes away, especially for vulnerable communities. Take the AIDS epidemic.
For some, HIV/AIDS is over, but for many, it is not. It's still a part of their own lives. It's part of their community. And it's transformed the world as they know it.
Whalew says if COVID sticks around, it will continue to disproportionately affect the elderly, people who can't be vaccinated, and workers in healthcare and nursing homes. And we might have to adjust some public norms to accommodate. Employers may need to build seasonal outbreaks into their calendars, assuming employees will call out sick and business will slow. People may have to wear masks during COVID season. And these kinds of changes often happen after major virus outbreaks.
Pandemics open up conversations and transform society, sometimes in ways that today we look back and we say, of course, you know, people have always washed their hands. Well, that's not true.
Hand washing didn't become more common until the 20th century during outbreaks of typhoid and tuberculosis. And condoms were only a method of birth control until the AIDS epidemic. Ultimately, Whalew says the pandemic will only end when people feel like it's over. For him, that'll be when someone near him coughs and he doesn't flinch. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Either you pay up or you're not going to run a business. That's it.
Seems harsh, but okay. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is up 122 points today, 1.2%, closed at 34,908. The NASDAQ jumped 348 points. That's about 2.5%, hence the really happy music, 14,139. or at least that's what I'm guessing. I'm not in charge. S&P 500 up 69 points, 1.5%, 44.71. We heard from Andy Euler about high oil prices and how that might finally start to sway how much we drive and spend on fuel. How about some road trip stocks, huh? Booking Holdings, they own Booking.com, up 3.5%. Airbnb beat estimates, upgraded 0.6%. Today, heard from Justin Ho about lumber. So lumber stocks, Boise Cascade, it's Boise, by the way, not Boise, grew 3.5%. West Fraser Timber fell 1%. Bond prices fell as well. Yield on the 10-year T-note, 2.04%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns. Meaning, when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal. Rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryzdal. We obviously don't know yet what's going to happen in Ukraine, despite today's glimpse of optimism. There is some well-founded skepticism in the West, of course, and some countries are already doing what they can to squeeze Moscow. The Brits are threatening economic sanctions against individuals with ties to the Kremlin, and they might actually have some leverage here. At least 50 of President Putin's closest oligarch buddies are believed to have had substantial assets in the UK, multi-million dollar real estate holdings in particular. Now, to be clear, London has threatened to go after those assets before. Might this time be different? From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard is on it.
Once the largest foreign investor in Russia, Bill Browder knows a thing or two about money and about the Russian leader.
It's pretty clear to me that the thing that Putin values most is his money.
Browder has long campaigned against Russian corruption, which he says starts at the very top.
Putin has been a kleptocrat for the last two decades. In that time, he's stolen a vast amount of money from the Russian state and from various people in Russia.
Putin has repeatedly denied such allegations. Browder instigated the Magnitsky Acts in the US, the UK and other countries. The laws imposed sanctions on Russian officials implicated in the death of Browder's Russian lawyer after he uncovered a massive tax fraud. Now Browder says it's time to target Putin's ill-gotten gains.
the best way of dealing with Putin in Ukraine is to go after his money in the West. Well, first of all, he can't keep that money in his own name. He's got to have people who he trusts hold that money. I call these people oligarch trustees.
And he says many of them have a lot of assets here in the UK. Some of those assets featured before the pandemic in a sightseeing coach trip.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Kleptocracy Tour of London. The aim is not only to expose the kleptocrats themselves.
Roman Borisovich, a Russian former banker and now anti-corruption campaigner, took a group of journalists on the Kleptocracy Tour through some of London's most exclusive neighbourhoods.
We showcased mansions, apartments, palaces attributed to Russian kleptocrats, but it's the very, very top of the iceberg.
Transparency International UK, the anti-corruption group, says there are at least 150 UK properties, $2 billion worth, owned by Russians with links to the Kremlin. Borisovich not only deplores the kleptocrats, but their British enablers as well.
They're being aided by an army of accountants, brokers, bankers, lawyers. These people are enabling this looting machine to exist.
But Russia's threatening manoeuvres on its borders with Ukraine is a turning point, says Foreign Secretary Liz Truss. She's just introduced tough new powers to freeze the UK assets of anyone with links to the Russian state.
Those in and around the Kremlin will have nowhere to hide.
But a statement in Parliament caused some hilarity. Many are sceptical about a crackdown on Russian assets. For one thing, says Transparency's Duncan Hames, there's a massive loophole. Any foreign individual buying property here can hide their identity behind an offshore company.
Until we get the reforms we've been calling for to reveal who's really behind the foreign companies that own property here, the government would be acting with one arm tied behind its back.
He says more than 85,000 properties in the UK are owned by anonymous entities registered abroad.
It is frankly astonishing that people can buy up bits of Britain and Britain doesn't get to know who they are.
The government says it'll close this loophole in later legislation, but Roman Borisovich has his doubts. After all, he says, the UK did not crack down on oligarch assets even after a nerve agent attack by Russians in the city of Salisbury in 2018.
I don't think that Russian aggression in Ukraine is any better reason to use these powers than killing of a British citizen on British soil with a nerve agent. They will not touch the oligarchs in London.
Embarrassingly for the UK, the US may share that scepticism. The Times newspaper quoted an American diplomat expressing the fear that Russian money is so entrenched in London now, the opportunity to use it as leverage against Putin may have been lost. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
A federal judge signed off on a debt restructuring deal for Puerto Rico last month. It has been 5 years now since the U.S. territory declared bankruptcy, 5 years in which the Puerto Rican economy has been battered by hurricanes and earthquakes and a pandemic. Chef Maria Mercedes Grubb has seen it all. The family-owned restaurant that she ran with her brother never fully recovered from Hurricane Maria, closed for good in 2019. Now, though, things might be different. Puerto Rico has just had a record-setting tourism year, and Maria Grubb is the executive chef of not one but two new restaurants in San Juan, where we caught up with her just as she was getting ready for evening service. Welcome to the program. Good to talk to you again.
Thank you, Kai. So great to be in the show again.
You are busy now opening two restaurants. Do I have that right?
That sounds about right.
How did that come to pass? Because last time we talked to you, it was much different.
It was very different. It was very bleak, like the rest of the world. It's just that, you know, for us, it's been bleak for a while now. So what happened was people, I guess there's been a surplus of money. I guess all the incentives that have been happening. Also, people that were trying to open things all the way back from the hurricane, they're finally getting it together. And I guess they had the extra time to make it happen while things were in a bit of a lockdown. And here I am.
Are you having the same labor problems that are happening on the mainland? I mean, is it challenging to find people to work there?
Oh, it's 100% super challenging. Huh. Like right now we're dealing with just schedule, let's say, 10 people for interviews, maybe
one shows up, if then. And if they do show up, maybe they'll take the job, but and they'll start the next day, no problem. But then the second day won't even show up.
How do you run a business like that?
It's very hard. Well, you don't get a lot of sleep, first of all. second of all, you cut back hours. That's what's been happening. Both of my places, I haven't been able to open five days a week. They're all 4 days, 3 days, because that's all the staff that we have.
And I imagine if you can't open full time, it's tricky to raise wages?
100%. I mean, we have to raise them anyway. I'm a chef, but I was a cook before. So my heart has always been in this mission of like paying more fairly. Yeah. And luckily, owners are understanding that either you pay up or you're not going to run a business. That's it. The sad part about it is that sometimes you're paying somebody that can barely hold a knife, the salary of somebody that has years of experience, because you know, people are aware that there's a shortage of staff, so people are walking in with no experience, demanding, you know, not entry-level pay.
Who are your customers? Who comes in to eat every night?
Well, I have a mix, you know. The restaurants, I had a restaurant for, you know, 8 years. So I have a lot of my customers that have been patiently waiting for 2 years while I wasn't really serving the public. They've been strolling in slowly but surely, locals. But also I have a lot of tourists. Hmm. Both the restaurants are in a very heavily tourist location. And then, you know, we have a new crop of people coming from the States that are buying property in Puerto Rico, and sometimes they'll venture out, but if not, they call me and I cook for them privately at their houses.
And how often do you do that, the private chef thing?
The private chef, I had to cut back because I'm opening the restaurants, but during the pandemic, that was literally what helped me through. Huh. They tend to be very high-end dinners and people that just want to entertain in their big homes, and you know, so that's, I've been getting a lot of those.
Yeah, which is great for you when you can get them, but it doesn't do much to spread the money out through the economy, right? I mean, when you go out to eat in a restaurant, you're paying the busboy, you're paying the waiter, and all that.
That is the problem, and that's also one of the reasons why I've been taking them less, because I want to focus in the restaurant and building staff and hopefully building careers, you know. The few that I have are very excited and willing to learn and just looking forward to the future. And I'm looking forward to hopefully molding new cooks in the island as much as I can.
Maria Mercedes Grubb, she's a chef in Puerto Rico running two restaurants now. We talk to her from time to time. Chef, thanks for your time, Chef. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
This final note on the way out today, about which, just no. Mark Zuckerberg, the CEO of Meta, held an all-staff today. He's trying to work on the company's culture amid its recent challenges and has apparently adopted a new corporate slogan. Actually, not apparently. This is it, and here it is. Meta, Metamates me. It's about, and this is a quote, being good stewards of our company and mission, Zuckerberg said, taking care of our company and each other. About which, yes, absolutely, but Metamates? All right, we're out of here. Here, though, is your moment of economic context. I guess you file this along with things that didn't happen. Pitchers and catchers were supposed to report to spring training today, but for the Major League Baseball lockout. Our digital and on-demand marketplace mates? Nah. Include Carrie Barber, Siobhan Brett, Dylan Mietnin, and Jen Nguyen, Olga Oxman, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.